The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
British Army Major Alan Marshall feels the cold metal barrel of an AK-47 assault rifle nestled into the back of his head. He looks up at the man holding the gun, African militia leader Fode Kale. Surrounding him are the West Side Boys, a 2,000-strong gang of heavily armed rebel fighters who live deep inside the jungles of Sierra Leone, West Africa. Kale tells Marshall that he's guilty of spying, a crime punishable by death, and in 5 seconds, he will be executed.
They had this chant, "What makes the grass grow?" And the kids had to chant back, "Blood, blood, blood. What makes the grass grow? Blood, blood, blood."
Then the West Side Boys begin a countdown. 5, 4, 3, 2. But what Kale doesn't know is that a few hundred feet away are 4 SAS fighters, and that soon, all hell is going to break loose. But why is a British major being held hostage 5,000 miles from home in Sierra Leone's heart of darkness? Welcome to Covert, a show about the shadowy world of international espionage and top-secret military operations. I'm Jamie Rennell, and I'm going to take you inside history's greatest special forces missions to learn about the brave soldiers who risked their lives to terminate the world's most wanted men, eliminate terrorist threats, and protect countless innocent lives.
The odds were against us, totally. I mean, you know, we flew into their village, into their backyard, with two of the biggest helicopters in the world. Do you know what I mean? And by rights, I mean, if they'd have been switched on, they should have smashed those choppers straight out of the sky. We'd have been lucky to get anybody in there. You know, so as it was, it couldn't pan out that way. We couldn't get to them. We couldn't do it that way. So, you know, we had to go in and give them a bloody nose.
As told by the people who were there. In this week's episode, one wrong turn puts a British military regiment in the hornet's nest and leads to one of the most dangerous special forces missions in history, Operation Certain Death. Sierra Leone is a country of picturesque white beaches, tropical weather, and lush rainforests. But the West African nation is no tourist destination. It is the battleground for one of the most gruesome and deadly civil wars in history.
The distinguished President of the United States of America, His Excellency Mr. William Jefferson Clinton.
Thank you very much, Mr. President, Mr. Secretary General, members of the Security Council. Today I would like to focus my peacekeeping remarks on Africa, where prosperity and freedom have advanced, but where conflict still holds back progress. We see it in Sierra Leone, where UN action saved lives but could not preserve the peace.
Damian Lewis is a best-selling author who has spent decades reporting on wars throughout the African continent.
It was at one time called the Switzerland of Africa because it was a very, very, very wealthy and well-to-do country just after colonial rule. In the next few decades, it descended into corruption, mayhem, and various rebel armies were fighting for control of the country.
Sierra Leonean diamonds are sold to the Western world, often via the terrorist organization Al-Qaeda, to the tune of $500 million a year. These rival armies killed over 50,000 people in their bid to take over the country's lucrative mines, giving their output the nickname Blood Diamonds. Lord Guthrie was the head of the British Army when the illegal trade was at its peak.
Well, Sierra Leone was in a chaotic state, very largely due to its neighbours and blood diamonds, which had become an extraordinarily important factor in the violence which was going on. And there had been many people killed in the most horrible ways. There had been genocide in certain areas, and the United Nations had gone in there, but actually were doing nothing. They were watching and had little sort of interest in closing and solving this problem.
One of the most notorious and vicious of these African rebel militias was the West Side Boys, 2,000 heavily armed soldiers who occupied fortified bases deep in the jungle. Phil Campion, a former SAS fighter who received secret intelligence briefings about the West Side Boys.
West African rebels, unpredictable at best, evil, callous, twisted, perverted even at worst, willing to do almost anything, probably going to be drugged, could be children, could be women involved. You know, you're going to see the lot. It's going to be the sort of like who's who of medieval tactics, maybe. You know, you can expect that there's going to be some pretty hideous stuff going on. You know, and we'd heard the reports of people running around with heads on sticks and using people as ashtrays, and, you know, even as far as, you know, people being abused in a sexual manner within those villages.
They were renowned for lopping off the limbs of men, women and children, in particular, in fact, women and children, and of course we're talking civilians. So they would chop arms off, they would chop feet off as well, and the aim of doing so, if you can even conceive of what the aim was to spread terror across the country in some strange way to prove their power. And the RUF and the West Side Boys believed by doing that, they would then terrorise the civilian population, force them to come onto their side and seize the country and seize control.
Despite the vast supply of resources, the country was the poorest nation on earth. The average life expectancy was only 36 years old. Sierra Leone was on the brink of collapse. Because it was a former British colony, the UK deployed forces in May of 2000 to assist in evacuating foreign nationals, particularly those from the United Kingdom and other Commonwealth countries, as well as to help support the country's struggling military. Britain's Defence Secretary Geoff Hoon decided to send in troops.
So the starting point was essentially to ensure that there was an escape route for anyone who wanted to leave. Part of the longer term ambition was to ensure that a democratically elected government in Sierra Leone remained in place in the face of brutal rebels who, for example, thought nothing of chopping off the arms of young children to demonstrate how strong they were. That kind of behaviour could not be acceptable to a democratic, civilised country. We were demonstrating a wider commitment of the Western world to what at the time was a struggling democracy in a very poor part of Africa. So I think there was an important symbolic value in our intervention.
But the West Side Boys felt threatened by the British. They were desperate to show the world they were still a force to be reckoned with. August 25th, 2000. On a quiet Friday afternoon, a convoy of three British military vehicles hurtled along a tarmac road in the jungle. Damien Lewis.
They were led by a British major, Major Marshall, with a Captain Flaherty in second in command, and the rest of the men were largely riflemen. So these were fighting soldiers equipped with assault rifles and the machine guns on the vehicles themselves.
Inside the vehicles were 17 armed soldiers from Britain's Royal Irish Regiment on a routine patrol. They were following a pre-planned route to a UN checkpoint when an unexpected radio message came through from Major Marshall, he wanted the convoy to explore a remote jungle village he had spotted on the map. The drivers obeyed the order and headed into the thick jungle. Also riding with the regiment that day was a member of the Sierra Leone Army, Lieutenant Musa Bangura, acting as a guide to Marshall's men. The moment Musa saw that they were heading off the main road, he immediately told Marshall to turn back, with the warning that the area was, quote, infested with West Side boys. Marshall ignored Musa. After all, how dangerous could the rebel army really be? I really hope you're enjoying Covert. And if you're like me, you can't get enough stories of real-life crime and intrigue. So I wanted to tell you about a new podcast that I'm really into right now. When you think of a criminal, what do you picture? A guy in a black mask? Maybe a gangster? Dr. Evil? What about a woman? Probably not, right? That's why I'm hooked on this new podcast, Female Criminals. Every week, the hosts go deep into the lives of infamous female criminals. And it's not just backstory and details of each woman's crimes. And these are some doozies. They really analyze the motive and psychology behind them. It's great stuff. And with a new episode coming out every Wednesday, there's a bunch of stories to dive into. So go to wherever you go to get your pods, Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Spotify, Google Play, and search for Female Criminals. Or visit parcast.com/criminals to start listening now. That's Parcast, parcast.com/criminals. I hope you like it. Let me know what you think.
The Land Rovers, the four-wheel drives the British soldiers were in, are driving down a very narrow jungle track. It's a dirt track in the jungle. There's thick vegetation to either side.
Musa warned the regiment again, but what he didn't realize was that it was already too late.
Unbeknown to them, they've already been spotted by the West Side Boys rebels, who had hidden checkpoints on either side of the jungle. And so the word has gone out that there's this force of British soldiers coming down to the rebel base.
As they travelled deeper into the jungle, the forest canopy above them was so dense that it blocked out the natural light, plunging the regiment into darkness. Marshall looked out of his rearview mirror and spotted a flash of color running through a lit section of the forest. Musa turned to look out of the window, where there were several faces staring back at him, almost within touching distance in the shady overgrowth.
They reached the riverside, where one side of the rebel base is situated, and immediately they get there, they're surrounded by what can only be described as a seething, screaming mob of West Side Boys rebels, dressed in every imaginable outfit you can think of. So pink wigs, dresses, ripped shirts, shorts, whatever it might be, and brandishing a plethora of weapons. So assault rifles, heavy machine guns, rocket propelled grenades.
Armed men began creeping toward the vehicles, each carrying assault rifles, and shouting angrily.
The British patrol pulled to a halt, and it's very clear very quickly that this is not a friendly situation. Behind them, there's a what the rebels call a cut-off. It's a large truck with a back cut off it, and a four-barreled heavy anti-aircraft weapon placed on it, so basically you can use it for ground fire. That's been pulled in behind the patrol, so their retreat has already been blocked by that cutoff. And in front of them, they've got a huge, great big rebel guy with a general-purpose machine gun slung across his front, blocking their way. Okay, and these rebels are clearly very angry, and they're also clearly out of their heads on drugs.
It was Musa's nightmare. He knew many of the group as former colleagues in the Sierra Leonean army, and to the rebels, he was a traitor for refusing to support their uprising. The doors to the truck were violently torn open, and Musa was pulled out into the jungle.
They had realized who Musa was, and so they saw Musa, they dragged him out of the vehicle, they stripped him naked, they basically laid him on the jungle floor, and they kicked him and beat him with their rifle butts half to death.
Then the leader turned to Marshall.
Colonel Savage, who's the commander of the West Side Boys, walks up to the first vehicle and he puts his pistol to the head of the British soldier driving it and says, "You get out of the vehicle now or I'll blow your head off. Words to that effect. The British soldier looks to his commander, the major, in terms of what do I do? And the major can only make one decision, obviously, get out of the vehicle. Bear in mind, the 17 soldiers, they're lightly armed. The West Side Boys, there's hundreds, and they are very, very heavily armed. However good they are, they're outnumbered and outgunned. There's no way out of there in the vehicles. They're all going to get massacred. It will be a bloodbath. And so the order's given to lay down the arms.
The unit was only just beginning to find out why he was known as Colonel Savage, as he punched Marshall and dragged him into the forest as well. Another man who served nearly 2 years with the West Side Boys was a 26-year-old known as Black Zorro. He was recruited by the rebels when he was just 14 and rose to become a trusted junior officer. His voice has been translated and spoken by an actor.
We saw them as a major threat. They came to our camp without authorization. We didn't know their intentions, and we thought they were here to spy on us. So we couldn't just let them leave. I don't know why they left the main road and came into our territory. It was a no-go zone for anybody except us.
When Marshall woke, he was lying in a wooden canoe being taken across a river. Standing above him, a boy who could be no older than 15 propelled the boat using a hand-carved wooden paddle. Marshall peered down at the foot of the canoe to find Musa about 10 feet away, curled up, bloodied, and bruised. But thankfully, he appeared to still be conscious.
In these dugout canoes, the British soldiers and Musa Bangura, the Sierra Leonean corporal, arrive at the rebel base Scuberi Banner. They're marched up through the rebel base, and, you know, you can imagine all the rebels are out there. All these kids, high on drugs, high on alcohol, dressed in these mad, crazy outfits. They're all out there staring at the British captives, hollering, yelping, whatever it might be.
The soldiers were shoved into a dimly lit hut. A corrugated iron roof had been haphazardly drilled onto four crumbling concrete walls. The glass in the window frames had been replaced with wooden slats. It was a makeshift prison. Marshall clambered to a crack in the wall and looked outside. There was a complex of huts with a main square. In the distance, he saw a large river that he recognized from the map. It is the Roquel River, Sierra Leone's largest waterway. Two armed men were sitting immediately outside, watching some kids playing nearby. Marshall repositioned himself to catch a glimpse of the kids. But to his horror, the children weren't playing a game. They were whipping Musa's limp body and dragging him around by his feet.
Musa Bangura, the Sierra Leonean corporal, is taken somewhere very different. He's taken to the edge of the jungle, where some sheets of corrugated iron are pulled aside, and there is a pit dug in the ground, which is half full of stagnant water, mud, urine, feces, whatever you can imagine, and all the sliding, slithering things of the jungle. And Musa is thrown into that pit, and the galvanized iron is put over the top of it. And it's dark in there, and he's basically in there to die. And when he gets in there, he realizes there's someone else in there too. And the person who's in there, Lord knows how long he's been in there for, but that guy is only barely alive.
Lord Guthrie and Britain's Defense Secretary Geoff Hoon had a crisis meeting in their situation room.
My name is Geoff Hoon. I was, from 1999 to 2005, the United Kingdom's Secretary of State for Defence, which is the equivalent position in the United States to Defence Secretary. I was responsible in the government for Britain's armed forces throughout that period. At the time, I suspect no one was particularly worried about that. However, clearly the next significant piece of information was that we were told that they had been captured by a group that we knew as the West Side Boys.
So you see, we weren't quite sure just how serious it was to start with.
At Ministry of Defence headquarters in London, news of the missing soldiers reached the head of the British Army, Lord Guthrie.
I knew about the West Side Boys. I'd been to Sierra Leone, I'd been briefed about them, but I wasn't quite sure what they would do.
Geoff Hoon, Lord Guthrie, and Prime Minister Tony Blair were at the time the most powerful people in Britain and directly responsible for signing off on military operations. The safety of the hostages fell directly in their hands and became their number one priority. Lord Guthrie.
The problem was, how were we going to release, how were we going to get these people who'd been kidnapped, who were in tremendous danger of either being tortured, killed, or split up around Sierra Leone.
They knew nothing. They had no intelligence. They had no eyes on the rebel base. They didn't know the rebel numbers. They didn't know what weaponry they had. And most worryingly of all, they didn't know whether the British soldiers would get killed in the rescue operation.
I talked to the Prime Minister about it and said, I think we're going to have to do something about this. We can't just let it roll on because things could get worse. And I remember him saying, well, is this very dangerous? I said, yes, very dangerous. Are people likely to be killed? I said, almost certainly. How many? I said, I can't answer that question. So there was a real urgency about this. But it wasn't so urgent that we didn't take a huge amount of trouble. We tried to negotiate. Scotland Yard were extremely good. They gave us two very wise, old, experienced negotiators who came and tried to negotiate.
I was perfectly content for negotiations to be begun, but I have to say in the background as well, we were always preparing to take military action to release them.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Three specialist hostage negotiators set out from London and landed 14 hours later at Freetown Airport in Sierra Leone, 100 miles from the West Side Boys base. They followed the same route Marshall took towards the checkpoint. As they approached the rebel base, the mud road suddenly became lined with heavily armed rebel fighters, many of whom were in their early teens. The negotiators turned a corner and entered what appeared to be a village made up of jungle huts. Ian Morrison is a seasoned hostage negotiator who worked in Sierra Leone for the British government.
The sheer unpredictability of that particular group meant that even if they were compliant and willing, in a good frame of mind today, you could not in any way be assured of the safety of the hostages tomorrow or the day after. It could change in the blink of an eye. It was highly unpredictable, highly volatile. And groups like this had already crossed the threshold of killing. These groups had killed many times before, and so that there wasn't that barrier to be crossed.
A man walked out to meet them with an entourage of bodyguards, carrying AK-47 assault rifles. The negotiators recognized him, 24-year-old Fode Kale, a vicious Sierra Leonean warlord known for his brutality and extortion. And he would be the one representing the rebels in the negotiations.
He was certainly very paranoid and very deluded. He believed his rebel group had the power to, for example, force the British out of Sierra Leone, force British military forces out of Sierra Leone, and take over the country.
Kale made a rambling series of demands, as simple as wanting amnesty for the West Side Boys to insisting all the British leave the country. He then demanded, ludicrously, that he should be made president of Sierra Leone. The negotiators were walking a dangerous tightrope. Kale's demands were impossible and could never be met, but to keep the hostages alive, they needed to keep him thinking that a deal could be made.
They were at continuing high risk of harm. The worst case scenario is that they would be killed at the outset, as a number of missionaries had been previously. So that was the good news. The bad news in this situation is the unpredictability and the volatility of the situation and the individuals concerned. So in the blink of an eye, you can move from a situation where you have stable, well-treated hostages to them being killed.
The negotiators had still not seen Major Marshall in person. They, in turn, demanded that if any demands are to be met, they need proof that Marshall is still alive. To their surprise, Calais agreed and stipulated that they would meet in the morning. Phil Campion.
There was a lot going on. There was negotiations being held with the West Side Boys, you know, so the negotiating teams were going in every day. They were buying people time, basically, and making sure that, you know, we'd have proof of life. So they said, we'll meet you, we'll give you whatever you want today. It might be an engine for their boat or a crate of beer, but you make sure you bring so-and-so with you. I don't want to see him, do you know what I mean? I want to see Private Bacon Neck.
That evening, two heavily armed men entered Marshall's hut and dragged him around the camp. The rebels blasted loud music into the jungle, drinking and taking drugs, and firing their guns into the air. They mocked the major as Calais repeatedly hit him. Despite the pain, Marshall could not afford to fight back. Any retaliation could result in suffering for his men. Again, here's the 26-year-old known as Black Zorro, whose voice has been translated and spoken by an actor.
Well, we used to smoke plenty of marijuana, and as for drink, we had lots of homemade strong alcohol called hard wine. Cocaine was sometimes available, but heroin was all over the place. If you went to the jungle at that time, you would find everyone high on heroin. I was often high all day. The drugs made me feel strong and ready for battle. As soon as I took them, I was ready for any fight.
As the major was paraded around and beaten, Calais showed off the group's air defense weapons and stash of AK-47s. He then promised that if there was any rescue attempt, he would kill the hostages and destroy the invading army. Marshall was thrown back into the hut, where he immediately asked his regiment if any of them had a pen or paper, and they did. He frantically began writing. Damien Lewis.
He recognized in these meetings an opportunity to pass over some vital intelligence in a clandestine fashion to the British side.
The people who'd been abducted here were professional military people. They understood, were fully aware that the intelligence that was being provided back to the UK component was potentially for use in a hostage rescue mission. And that, you know, they foresaw where this was going.
The next morning, Scotland Yard negotiators returned to the rebel base to check on Major Marshall's well-being. They saw that he was alive, despite obvious signs of bruising. But then, Marshall made a strange request. He asked if he could greet the negotiators in a traditional British way. The bemused Calais agreed. Marshall approached the negotiator, smiling and nodding enthusiastically, drawing attention to his face. As their hands met, the negotiator felt a sharp object in the base of Marshall's palm. Hundreds of armed militia were surrounding the two men, watching their every move like hawks. The secret object was now in between the men's palms. The negotiator looked back at the major and nodded sternly. He braced the object, cupping it into the ball of his fist, and let go of Marshall's hand. Marshall improvised and fist-bumped the negotiator. Calais' rebel army looked on in disbelief at the strange custom the Brits had as Marshall walked back to his regiment. Once a safe distance from the rebel camp, the negotiator opened the palm of his hand to find an unremarkable-looking pen lid. But as he lifted it up to look inside of it, a small, rolled piece of paper fell out.
What he had done is, during the various walkabouts that the rebels had proudly given them of the base, saying, "There is our anti-aircraft weapons, and there are our mortars, and there is a boy raping a girl," and these kind of things, during those walkabouts, Major Marshall had noted down every single defence that he could see that the West Boys had. And back in their room, where they were locked in captivity, he and the other men had drawn up a detailed map of the rebel base, mapping out all the positions and all their strengths. And he'd taken that piece of paper, rolled it up very tightly, and poked it inside a pen lid.
To the British, the map was invaluable. It marked which hut the regiment was being kept in, as well as the location of the militia's air defense systems. It also appeared to show that the rebels were split across two major bases on either side of the Rokel River.
You had 2,000 rebels, around about that number, based in these two bases, Gaberi Banner to the north of the river, and Magbeni, the other side of the rebel base, to the south of the river. You know, this is deep jungle. These are tin-roofed shacks. They're not major houses, but they've got serious weapons emplacements around both bases. So they have machine gun nests, they have mortar pits. This is a properly set up and orchestrated defendable base in the jungle. And it becomes very clear very quickly that whatever, if a force is going to have to go in and rescue those hostages, those British hostages, this is going to be a very serious operation and extremely high stakes are involved. And if it goes wrong, not only will hostages get killed, obviously, you'll have 17 dead British soldiers on your hands, but the rebels will succeed in doing Somalia on the British forces.
Back at the base, the negotiators relayed to Lord Guthrie that there was no chance of negotiating with the rebels' drug-crazed leader. But with Marshall's hand-drawn map, there was just enough intelligence to pinpoint the position of the hostages and begin planning a rescue mission. Lord Guthrie petitioned Prime Minister Tony Blair to take military action to rescue the captives.
And a lot of his advisers were saying, well, this is politically very bad. If it goes wrong, politically, it will be a disaster for you. And I said to him, it'll be also a disaster for you if 7 people get tortured, killed, awful things happen to them. And he thought about it and said, I think we must do it. And this was actually a very brave decision, and it's exactly what you hope the Prime Minister will do, and that is, first of all, take your advice, but secondly, make a bold decision.
With the Prime Minister's permission, Guthrie began planning for a military rescue operation. And when it came to hostage rescue and heavy firefights behind enemy lines, Lord Guthrie had the perfect force at his disposal, the SAS. AP journalist Kim Dozier.
The SAS, the British Special Air Services, they're the special operations force that we modeled all of our special operations after. They set the model for the rest of us to follow. Small unit, just a few hundred people, the elite of the elite. They have to go through a brutal entry course to prove that they measure up. It washes the majority of the applicants out.
Well, the SAS, I think everybody in the army would admit, are probably the most suitable people to do this. They are trained in special operations. They're trained in rescuing people who have been kidnapped. They've done it in other places.
Former SEAL Team 6 commando Don Mann.
Well, this selection process is the best. The selection to get into SBS, SAS is just phenomenal. They're tough soldiers. They cover everything from diving to navigation to jumping to shooting. And they're strict, they're disciplined, and they got the best troops coming to apply for this thing. We try to model after the SBS in our early years, and we still work closely with them.
The SAS are famous for being ready to fight in any environment and to carry out the missions with absolute secrecy. Those that make it through the notoriously difficult selection course are honored by having the SAS wings and dagger pinned or badged to their Army berets. Phil Campion is a badged SAS fighter and was sent to rescue Major Marshall and his men.
As a soldier, the reason I joined the SAS personally was it is the pinnacle of what I was trying to achieve. Now, I joined the Army to become a soldier. I didn't join the Army to be a mechanic. I didn't join the Army to be a chef or a bottle washer or spud peeler. I joined the Army to be a soldier and take up the duties that includes. And as a badged member of the SAS, that is about as pure as the driven snow as you can get in terms of soldiering. Obviously, you know, one of the regimental ethoses, if you like, is a continual pursuit of excellence. And so even though you get in the regiment, you don't sort of like just say, oh, I've made it now, you know what I mean, chuffed to pieces. You're continually trying to better yourself. So really, for me, to be a soldier and to serve with that regiment was the pinnacle of, you know, a career spent in the British Army.
The SAS have two particular specialties. One is storming difficult targets. In London, in 1980, they famously rescued 19 hostages, taking out a terrorist siege of the Iranian embassy.
The SAS pioneered the art of bursting onto a scene and rescuing hostages. That means things like fast roping from helicopters, breaching doors, throwing in a stun grenade to stun everyone inside, and then quickly firing and taking all of the hostile parties out, leaving the civilians. That is what they perfected.
The training for releasing hostages is quite intense, as you can imagine, because it's not, there's not a lot of room for error. You know, you don't get second chances when you're dealing with people's lives. So, you know, you have to make sure that if you're going to make mistakes, you make them in the exercises and you make them in training, because on the day of the race, if it goes wrong, and there have been cases, you know, you can look back in history, there have been cases where hostage releases have gone terribly wrong, you know, and obviously, A, you end up killing your own or killing hostages, or, you know, so there's a number of things can go absolutely catastrophically wrong. You know, it's one of the most difficult things to do is to rescue a life which is under threat, an immediate threat. You know, if you're just going into Banjo, a room full of insurgents, and there's nobody in there, well, let's stand off and give it from 10 yards away, do you know what I mean? But in this scenario, you can't just bash the whole lot over and go in and pick through the pieces. You've got to be more meticulous. It's more of a surgical type operation than just a let's go and car park the place.
The other specialty, jungle warfare.
Jungle warfare is, in many people's eyes, one of the purest forms of fighting. You know, you've got to really get atoned in with your surroundings. You can't, you know, there's no open spaces, it's closed in, it's a tight environment, you know, so it's on top of you. You know, you've got the elements against you from the start. You know, it's not a billiard table, there's not a piece of cover every 5 seconds, you know, it's throwing up all sorts of challenges. But that said, I enjoy being in the jungle because I enjoy a challenge. And most of the lads would say, yeah, I'll take the jungle. Yeah, too right, I'll take the jungle.
Campion's SAS unit prepared themselves to put both of these specialties into practice, but time was running short. The negotiators visited Calais one last time to try and reach a peaceful settlement. The warlord demanded time on the BBC to broadcast his grievances to the world. The British agreed, once again in return for hostages. Ian Morrison.
There was a major, major negotiating success in Operation Barris, which was the release of five of the soldiers in exchange for a radio and medicines. Now, that was a win-win situation for the UK, because one, it is worthwhile having effective and good communications, you know, with the hostile elements. Two, medicines are a good idea, particularly if they're going to be used to treat any of your individuals. And three, it provides intelligence opportunity.
The first thing he demands is a satellite phone, because what he wants to do, in his mind, is speak to the world's media and issue this set of demands, make me the president, you know, get the British out of the country, release all rebel prisoners, to broadcast those demands to the world's press. And that's exactly what he did. Fode Kelly gets given a satellite phone by the British forces. He phones up the BBC. And he does a live broadcast to the BBC, issuing the demand that they make him president of Sierra Leone to the world's media. They got five hostages released.
August 29th, 2000. The fifth day in captivity. Major Marshall looked up at the roof of his hut to see a section of corrugated iron swaying in the breeze. It wouldn't take much to climb out, but getting past the guards would be impossible, and even if they did escape, where would they go? The camp was surrounded by mangrove swamps on three sides and a fast-flowing river on the other. Without a machete or a boat, they would be tracked down in minutes. But what Marshall didn't know as he looked at the fauna outside was that he was staring directly at four SAS fighters, camouflaged by the tropical overgrowth on the perimeter of the base. They had spent the past 48 hours crawling at an almost motionless pace through the jungle and mosquito-filled swamps to get into position. Journalist Kim Dozier.
They know how to quietly get into a scene if necessary, whether it's marching into a jungle invisibly and sitting in an observation post under a tarp for 3 weeks staring at a target so that nobody knows they're there. That's what they do.
That team was tasked with setting up an observation post, an OP. An OP is a Basically, it's like a grave dug in the jungle floor. You dig a pit, you jump in the pit, you cover it with vegetation, and you lie there for as long as it takes to keep eyes on the base until either the mission is called in and it happens, or the mission's called off and you withdraw. The reason being for putting those guys there was so that the British force, the British commanders, had their own people on the ground in visual range of the base with eyes on what was happening there, so they could check the location of the hostages, they could check what was happening to the rebels, and report it all back by radio to headquarters.
This kind of surveillance was another SAS specialty that takes endless reserves of patience and skill. The men must eat, sleep, and maintain their watch for days on end, making only the smallest of movements.
Throughout the special operations world, they have this expression, the quiet professionals. And these guys, when they're out on the mission, that's really what they are.
The observational team were also tasked with finding the best way to attack the rebel base, but what they reported back to Lord Guthrie was bad news. He had hoped to send in a team by boat, but the river was full of concealed sandbanks. If the Special Forces boats became grounded, the fighters would be sitting ducks. The observation team reported that an attack by land was also nearly impossible. The only option was a full frontal assault by helicopter. Phil Campion.
We could have sneaked up and not fired a shot and taken everybody down without killing anybody, then that would have been probably the preferred option. As it was, it couldn't pan out that way. We couldn't get to them. We couldn't do it that way. So, you know, we had to go in and give them a bloody nose.
There was only one kind of helicopter up for the job, the twin-rotor HC-2 Chinook. But it has its drawbacks. Jeff Hoon.
One of the obvious thing about a helicopter is that they are very noisy, and the element of surprise is lost if the enemy can hear a helicopter coming at distance.
Chinooks can carry a huge payload, but they're also slow, hard to maneuver, and easy to spot, hence their unofficial nickname, the flying school bus.
If a Chinook gets hit and knocked out of the sky with a large number of SAS people in it, it would be very serious.
To complicate matters, the main base across the river was heavily armed. It had a battery of heavy weapons, including rocket-propelled grenades, heavy machine guns, and mortars, any of which could easily shoot a Chinook out of the sky or rain artillery fire down on the hostage camp. With that kind of weaponry, a rescue mission would quickly turn into a suicide mission. The SAS commanders had no choice but to rethink the entire operation. Before they can act, the rebel leader grew impatient with the endless rounds of negotiations. Lord Guthrie.
Negotiations had failed.
The SAS observational unit watched motionlessly as Marshall was dragged across the camp. The rebels then entered the hostage hut.
They beat the living daylights out of the young British hostages. It was a free-for-all. They just invited all the rebels to come in and kick and punch and use their rifle butts and gave them a severe, severe beating.
Fode Calais began counting down. 5, 4, 3. The SAS observational unit radioed into base, asking for authorization to kill Fode, to start a firefight, to rescue Marshall. 2, 1. A radio message came through.
Hold fire.
Marshall fell to the floor, and the rebel fighters cheered loudly. It was a mock execution, but next time, in all likelihood, the gun would be loaded. In the Houses of Parliament in London, Defence Secretary Hoon heard about the mock execution.
We were certainly receiving very detailed information about what was going on inside the huts where our men were being held prisoner, and I think one of the key pieces of information I received is that they were being subject to mock executions, that weapons were being pointed at them, apparently being fired, and that kind of behaviour was totally unacceptable as far as I was concerned.
For the Defence Secretary, this was the proof he needed that Calais could not be reasoned with. He gave Lord Guthrie the green light to take real military action. But after the mock execution, the British were no longer satisfied with just rescuing the hostages. They were going to send a message to militia groups throughout Sierra Leone. Lord Guthrie readied his best fighters. The SAS were going behind enemy lines. In part two of Operation Certain Death, we follow the SAS as they enter the heart of darkness and are met with one of the fiercest battles they ever faced down.
Option A, the river, was impassable. The kind of jungle around the rebel bases was secondary jungle, which is basically impenetrable, that it was impossible to get in overland. So option B, plan B, was also off the cards. That left only option C, which is the assault by air. And that was the least preferable option. That was the option no one wanted to have to consider, because if you flew into a rebel base, you'd have to go in via Chinook helicopter, and you would be a big, noisy, very vulnerable helicopter packed full of troops flying into a rebel base where they knew they had anti-aircraft emplacements. And so it was the means of insertion which offered least chance of success. And at that stage, when they realised they could only go in via air, that was when the men of the SAS, the men who were tasked to go in and do this hostage rescue, coined the phrase, the nickname for the mission, Operation Certain Death.
That's next time on Covert. Covert is an audio boom and World Media Rights co-production, hosted by me, Jamie Rennell. It is produced by Audio Boom's Ben Hosley and Rachel Jacobs, and by Pascal Hughes for World Media Rights. We had editing help by David Markowitz, with additional production from World Media Rights by Gerald Zabengwa and Damian Thorpe. David McNabb is the series' creative director, and the executive producers for Audio Boom are Brendan Regan and Stuart Last. If you haven't already, don't forget to follow us on Spotify or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorite shows. And if you've got some time, give us a review.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right.